She headed straight back toward the field without another word. Reacher was left alone at the church gate. He stepped through and headed onward toward the building itself, waited at the door. It was a huge thing, carved oak, maybe 4 inches thick. It had iron bands and hinges, big black nail heads. Above it, the tower rose 70 feet vertically into the sky. There was a flag and a lightning rod and a weather vane on the top. The weather vane was not moving, the flag was limp, the air was completely still. Cold, dense air, no breeze at all. The sort of air that takes a bullet and wraps around it and holds it lovingly, straight and true. A minute later, there was the noise of shoes on the gravel, and he looked back at the gate and saw the church warden approaching. He was a small man in a black surplice that reached his feet. He had a cashmere coat over it, a fur hat with ear flaps tied under his chin, thick eyeglasses in gold frames, a huge wire hoop in his hand with a huge iron key hanging off it. It was so big it looked like a prop for a comic movie about medieval jails. He held it out, and Reacher took it from him. "That's the original key," the warden said, "from 1870. "I'll bring it back to you," Reacher said. "Go wait for me on the field."
"I can wait right here," the guy said.
"On the field," Reacher said again. "Better that way." The guy's eyes were wide and magnified behind his glasses. He turned around and walked back the way he had come. Reacher hefted the big old key in his hand, stepped to the door and lined it up with the hole, put it in the lock, turned it hard. Nothing happened. He tried again. Nothing. He paused, tried the handle. The door was not locked. It swung open 6 inches with a squeal from the old iron hinges. He remembered the noise. It had sounded much louder when he opened the door at 5 in the morning. Now it was lost in the low-level hubbub coming from 300 people on the field. He pushed the door all the way open, paused again, and then stepped quietly through into the gloom inside. The building was a simple wooden structure with a vaulted roof. The walls were painted a faded parchment white. The pews were worn and polished to a shine. There was stained glass in the windows. At one end there was an altar and a high lectern with steps leading up to it. Some doors to small rooms beyond. Vestries, maybe. He wasn't sure of the terminology. He closed the door and locked it from the inside, hid the key inside a wooden chest full of hymnals, crept the length of the center aisle and stood still and listened. He could hear nothing. The air smelled of old wood and dusty fabrics and candle wax and cold. He crept on and checked the small rooms behind the altar. There were 3 of them, all small, all with bare wooden floors, all of them empty except for piles of old books and church garments. He crept back, through the door, into the base of the tower. There was a square area with 3 bell ropes hanging down in the center. The ropes had yard-long, faded, embroidered sleeves sewn over the raw ends. The sides of the square area were defined by a steep, narrow staircase that wound upward into the gloom. He stood at the bottom and listened hard, heard nothing, eased himself up. After 3 consecutive right-angle turns, the stairs ended on a ledge. Then there was a wooden ladder bolted to the inside of the tower wall. It ran upward 20 feet to a trap door in the ceiling. The ceiling was boarded solid, except for 3 precise 9-inch holes for the bell ropes. If anybody was up there, he could see and hear through the holes. Reacher knew that. He had heard the dogs pattering around below him 5 days ago. He paused at the foot of the ladder, stood as quiet as possible, took the ceramic knife out of his coat pocket, and shrugged the coat and suit jacket off and left them piled on the ledge. Stepped onto the ladder. It creaked loudly under his weight. He eased upward to the next rung. The ladder creaked again. He stopped, took 1 hand away from the rung it was gripping, and stared at the palm. Pepper. The pepper he had used 5 days ago was still on the ladder. It was smeared and smudged on the rungs, maybe by his previous descent 5 days ago, maybe by some new ascent undertaken today by the cops, or by somebody else. He paused, eased up another rung. The ladder creaked again. He paused again. Assess and evaluate. He was on a noisy ladder 18 feet below a trap door. Above the trap door was an uncertain situation.
He was unarmed except for a knife with a blade 3.5 inches long. He took a breath, opened the knife and held it between his teeth, reached up and grasped the side rails of the ladder as far above his head as he could stretch, catapulted himself upward. He made the remaining 18 feet in 3 or 4 seconds. At the top, he kept 1 foot and 1 hand on the ladder and swung his body out into open space, stabilized himself with his fingertips spread on the ceiling above, felt for movement. There was none. He reached out and poked the trapdoor upward an inch and let it fall closed, put his fingertips back on the ceiling. No movement up there. No tremor, no vibration. He waited 30 seconds. Still nothing. He swung back onto the ladder and pushed the trapdoor all the way open and swarmed up into the bell chamber. He saw the bells hanging mute in their cradles, 3 of them with iron wheels above, driven by the ropes. The bells were small and black and cast from iron. Nothing like the giant bronze masterpieces that grace the ancient cathedrals of Europe. They were just plain rural artifacts from plain rural history. Sunlight came through the louvers and threw bars of cold light across them. The rest of the chamber was empty. There was nothing up there. It looked exactly as he had left it. Except it didn't. The dust was disturbed. There were scuffs and unexplained marks on the floor. Heels and toes, knees and elbows. They weren't his from 5 days ago, he was sure of that. And there was a faint smell in the air, right at the edge of his consciousness. It was the smell of sweat and tension and gun oil and machined steel and new brass cartridge cases. He turned a slow circle, and the smell was gone like it had never been there at all. He stood still and put his fingertips against the iron bells, willing them to give up their secret stored vibrations. Sound came through the louvers, as well as sunlight. He could hear people clustered near the base of the tower 70 feet below. He stepped over and squinted down. The louvers were weathered wooden slats, spaced apart, and set into a frame at angles of maybe 30 degrees. The fringe of the crowd was visible, the bulk of it was not. He could see cops on the perimeter of the field, 30 yards apart, standing easy and facing the fences. He could see the community center building. He could see the motorcade waiting patiently in the lot, with the engines running and exhaust vapor clouding white in the cold. He could see the surrounding houses. He could see a lot of things. It was a good firing position. Limited field. But it only takes one shot. He glanced upward. Saw another trap door in the bell chamber's ceiling, and another ladder leading up to it. Next to the ladder there were heavy copper grounding straps coming down from the lightning rod. They were green with age. He had ignored the ceiling on his previous visit. He had experienced no desire to climb through and wait 8 hours out in the cold. But for somebody looking for an unlimited field of fire on a sunny afternoon, the trap door would be attractive. It was there for changing the flag, he guessed. The lightning rod and the weather vane might have been there since 1870, but the flag hadn't. It had added a lot of stars since 1870. He put the knife back between his teeth and started up the new ladder. It was a 12-foot climb. The wood creaked and gave under his weight. He made it halfway and stopped. His hands were on the side rails. His face was near the upper rungs. They were ancient and dusty, except for random patches where they were rubbed perfectly clean. There were 2 ways to climb a ladder. Either you hold the side rails, or you touch each rung with an overhand grip. He rehearsed in his mind how the grip pattern would go. There would be contact, left and right on alternate rungs. He arched his body outward and looked down, craned his neck and looked up. He could see clean patches in that exact pattern, to the left and right on alternate rungs. Somebody had climbed the ladder, recently, maybe within a day or two. Maybe within an hour or two. Maybe the church warden hanging a laundered flag? Maybe not. He hung motionless. Chatter from the crowd drifted up to him through the louvers. He was up above the bells. The maker had soldered his initials on top of each of them where the iron narrowed at the neck. A.H.B. was written there 3 times over in shaky lines of melted tin. He eased upward, placed his fingertips as before on the wood above his head. But these were thick balks of timber, probably faced with lead on the outside surface. They were as solid as stone. A guy could be dancing a jig up above and he would never feel it. He eased up two more rungs, hunched his shoulders, and stepped up another rung until he was crouched at the top of the ladder with the trapdoor pressing down on his back. He knew it would be heavy. It was probably as thick as the roof itself, and weatherproofed with lead, some kind of a lip arrangement on it to stop rain leaking through. He twisted around to look at the hinges. They were iron, a little rusted, maybe a little stiff. He took a long, wet breath around the knife handle and snapped his legs straight and exploded up through the trap. It crashed back, and he scrambled up and out onto the roof into the blinding daylight, grabbed the knife from his mouth and rolled away. His face grazed the roof. It was lead, pitted and dulled and grayed by more than 130 winters. He snapped upright and spun a full circle on his knees. There was nobody up there. It was like a shallow, lead-lined box, open to the sky at the top. The walls were about 3 feet high. The floor was raised in the center to anchor the flagpole and the weather vane post and the lightning rod. Up close, they were huge. The lead was applied in sheets, carefully beaten and soldered at the joints. There were shaped funnels in the corners to drain rainwater and snowmelt away. He crawled on his hands and knees to the edge. He didn't want to stand. He guessed the agents below were trained to watch for random movement taking place in high vantage points above them. He eased his head over the parapet, shivered in the frigid air. He saw Armstrong directly below. The new senator was standing next to him. The six agents were surrounding them in a perfect circle. Then he saw movement in the corner of his eye. 100 yards away, across the field, cops were running. They were gathering at a point near the back corner of the enclosure. They were glancing down at something and spinning away and hunching into their radio microphones. He looked directly down again and saw Froelich forcing her way out through the crowd. She had her index finger pressed under her earpiece. She was moving fast, headed toward the cops. He crawled back again and clambered down through the trap door, slammed it shut above his head, and climbed down the ladder. Through the next trap door and down the next ladder, he picked up his coat and jacket and ran down the narrow winding stairs, past the embroidered ends of the bell ropes and through to the main body of the church. The oak door was standing wide open. The lid of the hymnal box was up, and the key was in the door lock from the inside. He stepped over and stood a yard inside the building, waited, listened, sprinted out into the cold and stopped again 6 feet down the path, spun around. There was nobody waiting to ambush him, nobody there at all. The area was quiet and deserted. He could hear noise far away on the field. He shrugged into his coat and headed toward it, saw a man running toward him across the gravel, fast and urgent. He was wearing a long brown coat, some kind of heavy twill, halfway between a raincoat and an overcoat. It was flapping open behind him, tweed jacket and flannel pants under it, stout shoes. He had his hand raised like a greeting, a gold badge palmed in the hand, some kind of a Bismarck detective, maybe the police captain himself.
"Is the tower secure?"
he shouted from 20 feet away.
"It's empty," Reacher shouted back. "What's going on?"
The cop stopped where he was and bent over, panting, his hands on his knees.
"Don't know yet," he called. "Some big commotion."
Then he stared beyond Reacher's shoulder at the church.
"Damn it, you should have locked the door," he called. "Can't leave the damn thing open."
He raced on toward the church. Reacher ran the other way to the field, met Nagley running in from the entrance road.
"What?"
she shouted.
"It's going down," he shouted back.
They ran on together. Through the gate and into the field, Froelich was moving fast toward the cars. They changed direction and cut her off.
"Rifle hidden at the base of the fence," she said.
"Someone's been in the church," Reacher said. He was out of breath. "In the tower, probably right on the roof. Probably still around someplace."
Froelich looked straight at him and stood completely still for a second. Then she raised her hand and spoke into the microphone on her wrist.
"Stand by to abort," she said. "Emergency extraction on my count of three."
Her voice was very calm.
"Stand by all vehicles. Main car and gun car to target on my count of three."
She paused a single beat.
"One, two, three. Abort now. Abort now."
Two things happened simultaneously. First, there was a roar of engines from the motorcade, and it split apart like a starburst. The lead cop car jumped forward, and the rear cop car slewed backward, and the first two stretch limos hauled through a tight turn and accelerated across the gravel and straight out onto the field. At the same time, the personal detail jumped all over Armstrong and literally buried him from view. One agent took the lead, and the other two took an elbow each, and the backup three piled on and threw their arms up over Armstrong's head from behind and drove him bodily forward through the crowd. It was like a football maneuver, full of speed and power. The crowd scattered in panic as the cars bumped across the grass one way and the agents rushed the other way to meet them. The cars skidded to a stop and the personal detail pushed Armstrong straight into the first and the backup crew piled into the second. The lead cop had his lights and sirens started already and was crawling forward down the exit road. The two loaded limos fishtailed on the grass and turned around on the field and headed back to the pavement. They rolled up straight behind the cop car, and then all three vehicles accelerated hard and headed out while the third stretch headed straight for Froelich. "We can get these guys," Reacher said to her. "They're right here, right now." She didn't reply, just grabbed him and Nagley by the arms and pulled them into the limo with her. It roared after the lead vehicles. The second cop fell in directly behind it, and just 20 short seconds after the initial abort command, the whole motorcade had formed up in a tight line and was screaming away from the scene at 70 miles an hour, with every light flashing and every siren blaring. Froelich slumped back in his seat.
"See," she said, "we're not proactive. Something happens, we run away."